Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for tuning in to today's program. Hope you had a wonderful day yesterday. Glad to have you listening in on this conversation ahead. I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Ross at the controls. And Ted, we're kind of both football fans. So
yeah.
Did you play, actually? Or
No. Never, I did. No. I won a punt, pass, and kick competition. That's about it, though.
All right. Okay. So, I actually never did. So other than, just playing with friends in the playground. But so, actually, I don't know that I've actually been in a huddle.
Yeah, I don't think I have either, if I'm honest.
No. We're going to talk about breaking the huddle today.
Okay, that's where you go and put your plan into action, right?
Sure. 1, 2, 3, break.
Yeah, that's right.
We're going to talk about breaking the huddle today. And it actually doesn't have anything to do with football, which will be disappointing to a few of our listeners. Yeah. But I hope you'll stick around because we're going to have a good conversation. Our friend Don Everts is back with us today. We've talked to Don in the past about his great writing. He's written a couple of books, including I Once Was Lost and Go and Do, and we've chatted with him about both those books. Don's a minister of outreach at Bonham Presbyterian Church. It's in a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri, and he spends time cultivating relationships with people who are generally skeptical of Christians. Has a passion for evangelism and global justice, previously served as an area director for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship in Boulder, Colorado. And we're talking about a new book that he's co-written called Breaking the Huddle, How Your Community Can Grow Its Witness. I think all of us admit that we want to be more effective in sharing our faith. I mean, at our heart, we do, and maybe it's one of your goals in this new year. Say, how do I more winsomely and effectively and naturally tell others about this so precious faith? So we'll talk about it today. We've got some copies of the book to give away. Don, welcome back to Connecting Faith. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Neil. Great to be with you today.
This kind of comes out of some earlier research that you did, and maybe, go back and tell us a bit about the story about I Once Was Lost, because out of that, it was a pretty, I think, thoughtful and significant discussions that you had with several of your team and the different teams around the university world about how people come to faith in this postmodern era.
Yeah, so, it was really a couple decades ago now that kind of in the laboratory of college ministry, and a lot of culture change hits campuses first. And so college ministries were some of the first folks to really start dealing with these strange creatures called postmodern folks, just seeing what it was like and how our kind of habits in evangelism and our established ways of sharing the faith, really when the postmodern folks started hitting campus, our ways of sharing the faith just weren't resonating with people, weren't connecting with them. And so it was a time of a lot of experimentation, and that led to, seeing folks come to faith. And then really, and Doug Schaub, who was my co-author and really the start of a lot of this at the ground level, had the wise thought of just starting the habit of interviewing new Christians and just listening to their stories. What happened to you? You used to be skeptical, cynical about the church. Now you're a believer. What was your story? And so it was kind of really over maybe an 8-year period in a certain region, there were over 2,000 conversions. And through staff people, through direct interviews, just listening to their stories and then finding these common themes that kept popping up, five common themes that kept popping up in people's stories, and that's what led to kind of just this set of observations that we called the five thresholds of postmodern conversion. Kind of here's five common areas in someone's story, and if you reverse engineer that as a believer, as a church, as a Bible study, you can learn, actually, how can I be more helpful to people these days? And helpful for them on their journey as God's calling them into his family. And that's really where all this started.
You know, before, and we'll talk about these, the five thresholds, but I'm curious to know, maybe you can't do it without explaining them, but how is it different from, say, 30 years ago? Obviously, you're talking about postmoderns, a world think a little differently, but why should it be different? Or maybe is there one significant difference from, say, someone who was sharing faith, 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah, so, there are a few larger differences. So trust is a really big one, and the amount of trust people have for organizations in general is a lot lower now, and specifically the amount of trust people have for Christians, for the church, for organized religion, et cetera, has really plummeted in the last few decades. And so that's a big change, where 30, 40 years ago, did you have some people who were cynical about the church or organizations? Absolutely. But it wasn't as prevalent. It wasn't as deep. And so the loss of trust is a really big thing. We're in some people call it post-Christian age now, where 30, 40 years ago, even non-Christians knew a lot of the Bible. And they understood a lot of Christian language. And they had a kind of a grounding in kind of a Judeo-Christian understanding of the world and the literature of the Old and New Testaments, and now that's no longer the case. And so a lot of the language that we would have used or assumed that people would understand and that was intelligible to people simply isn't anymore. So that's two examples. I go on for some others, but there have been things that have changed kind of in the characteristic moods and tendencies and assumptions of people in culture. And just as if you went to a new country, a different country, you would learn the language there. You wouldn't go to Guatemala and presume you could speak the gospel in English and have people understand it. Really, the culture has been changing around us in such a way that all of us, even if we've never moved, we've become itinerant ministers. And we're now surrounded by a new people, and so it's incumbent upon all of us to say, okay, as a good missionary, following the example of Jesus who put on flesh to talk to flesh, how do we learn to speak a language and to speak in categories that the people around us can actually hear now?
And we do. That is our goal, our objective, is our commission, right, to go, make disciples, to share the good news. So how do we do that effectively? Well, we're going to dive in as we continue our conversation. Breaking the Huddle is the name of the book, How Your Community Can Grow Its Witness, and we'll get to kind of the community picture of it as we go along. But so we've been sort of teasing out, there's five thresholds. You mentioned trust. That's kind of the key one. Let's talk about those five to set up our conversation.
Yeah, in brief, this is kind of how people's stories went, that they often told a story, I had been hurt by the church, or I had a Christian who had hurt me, and so I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then I had this coworker, and then I had this roommate, and then there's this relative of mine who moved closer. There's this beautiful thing that happens when someone, a non-Christian, actually trusts a single Christian. And that all the stories we heard, almost all of them, it began with the non-Christian trusting a single Christian. And that's really meaningful. And that it kind of got them in the game. And trusting a Christian is very different than accepting Jesus, but it's the first step, just having that trust. And it naturally leads to the second threshold, kind of the second most common part of people's stories, was when they became fascinated by Jesus, just curious about him. And they kind of moved from a place of being apathetic or indifferent about Jesus to actually curious about Jesus, not curious about Christianity, but curious about the person of Jesus. And that there's something about that spark of curiosity about Jesus himself that is key for folks' stories. So that's kind of the first and second threshold, learning to trust a Christian, which obviously isn't something that happens fast, and then having your curiosity about Jesus aroused. So that's kind of thresholds one and two.
Let's do the other three, and then we'll take a break.
Right. Great. So then the third threshold was when folks moved from being closed to change in their life to being open to change in their life. There are a lot of folks who, and I've known many of them and many of my friends, who they trust a Christian, you know, some of them trusting me. They're curious about Jesus, and in fact, they become a fan of Jesus. That postmodern folks find Jesus to be very fascinating, but they're not really open to any change in their life. They're not looking for a new worldview. They're not looking to change how they live life, and that's the third threshold, is when some beautiful, mysterious, wonderful things happen, and someone actually moves from being closed to change to being open to change, and they say, maybe he has something that could help me. And it's this sense of holy discontent. Like, maybe he can help me have a better marriage. Maybe there is something in Jesus that could add to my life. That's the third threshold. The fourth threshold is the most subtle. This is the last one that we really identified in all the stories that we were hearing. And that is when someone moves from kind of meandering towards God to actually seeking and being on a quest. It's, you know, I've had friends who, even when they became open to change, there wasn't an urgency about it, right? I mean, they were, if I invited them to come to church, maybe they would come, and they would, yeah, maybe I'll get something out of this. But they weren't wanting to come to conclusions. They weren't on a quest. They weren't saying, I want to come to a conclusion about this. And that's that fourth threshold, when something flips in someone, and they decide, I'm not just going to meander towards God. I actually want to come to conclusions. And that's a big change in someone's journey, and which leads, for some people, to the fifth threshold, and that is where they say, I actually want into the kingdom. I want to give my life to Jesus and surrender to him. That's the line in the sand that we're used to thinking about over decades and decades, the moment when someone decides to follow Jesus. What's unique in among postmodern folks is the significance and the importance of those early four steps that lead up to that line in the sand.
In the next few moments, we'll talk about ways that we can develop this not only individually but as a believing community. And what does that look like in our churches? Can we actually grow our witness in our churches? What would that be like? We're talking Breaking the Huddle today with Don Everts. Don is a co-author of this new book. We've got some copies to give away. You'll find it to be a very helpful resource, maybe offer some very challenging and strategic conversation for your ministry team, or maybe your small group, or just you as an individual. And you can sign up for a free copy. We'll do a drawing at the end of the hour. It's 877-933-2484. 877-93-FAITH is the number to call to sign up for a copy of Breaking the Huddle. Don Everts, Minister of Outreach at Bonham Presbyterian Church in Chesterfield, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis. And he spends his time cultivating relationships with people who are generally skeptical about faith, and we're going to find out how we can transform our churches. And maybe you're in a church that is effective and winsome in their witness, or maybe you would love it to be, and you wonder, well, does that only happen in big, mega churches, or can we do it in our church? We'll get Don's perspective on that, maybe how it's worked in his church as well. All that's coming up in just a moment. Important part of what it means to be effective in sharing our faith is to invite God's Spirit to go before us and to dwell and to fill us as we want to be winsomely sharing, witnessing for Jesus. We're talking Breaking the Huddle, and we're getting great coaching from Don Everts, who is a great coach who spends his time as a minister of outreach at Bonham Presbyterian Church in Chesterfield, Missouri. He's written several books, including Jesus with Dirty Feet, Go and Do, I Once Was Lost. And he's co-author of a new book called Breaking the Huddle. We're talking about how your community can grow its witness. And, Don, you do talk about there are several general categories of churches in their understanding of evangelism. Let's just break those down a bit.
Yeah, and so this came, my co-authors and I kind of interacting with a lot of churches who wanted to grow in evangelism, right? So they would hear about the five thresholds, and they would say, we would love to learn that as a church. And one of the things that we began to find is, even among churches that are saying, we would love to grow in our evangelism, in our effectiveness at reaching the community around us, even among churches who have that same desire, many of them are in different starting places than each other. And that really kind of affected, like, okay, well, what do you need to do next to grow in your evangelism? And that's what kind of led us in trying to be more helpful in our coaching to folks to kind of name, okay, and we kind of landed on really there are three kinds of churches that we've interacted with. So we call them huddled churches is the first category, witnessing churches, and conversion churches. And so these are three different kinds. And the huddled churches are churches where it's what it sounds like in the sense that it's a church of believers, faithful believers in many cases, who are more huddled together, and they're not really engaging the world around them. Even if they want to grow in witness, their current status is that they're huddled. Then there are witnessing churches, and those are ones that, you know, they're doing some evangelism. Witness is a value. You have some individuals in the church who are actively sharing their faith, and maybe you would even see one or two conversions a year, you know, that kind of thing. And then there are conversion churches, and these were the ones, I mean, they were blowing us away and teaching us a lot, and these are places where conversion is normal, where folks coming to faith is a regular thing, that witness isn't just a value, but it shapes everything that they do as a church. Lots of non-Christians are involved in the community. So the image we have is three different kinds of trees, if you will. One is a tree with very few leaves. That would be the huddled church. So it's alive. Things are happening. God can use it. But relative to witness, there's not a lot currently going on. Then there's kind of a medium tree, you know, where there is some evangelism happening, but it's not necessarily the norm. And then there are churches that are just red hot and are doing a lot in evangelism. And as we began to interview and talk with and meet with different churches that were in different places, we began to see some commonalities between different huddled churches. You can have a huddled church that's really big or really small. You can have an on-fire conversion church that's really big or really small. The size didn't matter as much as some of the habits, some of the leadership approaches, the language they used, and that's what was fascinating to us.
I'll talk about some of those habits in a moment. Just curious, so can one person or the influence of one person break the huddle if you're in a huddle church?
That's a great question. I would say yes. You know, and it's harder, right, to change a whole church as a single individual, and that's some of what we learned is that actually some of the structures of a church, some of what the leadership is about, some of the vision of the church, it actually matters a great deal. And so that was part of our learning. Actually, leadership's really significant in helping a church change its witness temperature. But we also have examples. I mean, there's something crazy that happens when you see someone come to faith, you know. If you have one person in a church who's actively doing evangelism and people are seeing new people find life in the church, that's a spark that can go a long way. I guess I would put it that way. I mean, that really can make other people hungry for the same kind of experience. And in that sense, evangelism begets evangelism. And so there is great hope for a single individual. And we also learned there are things that leaders can do and should do that actually can make a big difference in making creating a culture of evangelism easier.
Is it, as we talk maybe about some of the habits, I'm just curious, is it a matter of how we see the world around us and see those outside the church walls? You know, maybe we have our skeptical say, well, they would never, you know, they could never come to faith, or, you know, they're unlikely candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that, yes. Yeah. So one of the features in a huddled church that we talk about in the book is that in huddled churches, they tend to not interact with, they view evangelism as special, and they don't necessarily prioritize relationship with outsiders. And so if you're in a church where your habit is to focus on your own needs and avoid outsiders, that has a way, and you know, there are churches who, for example, really, really, really value holiness, right? And so they want to live holy before God, and so they view the world around them as kind of an enemy, right? And we don't want to be tainted by the outside world. And so as a matter of, so they tend to see the non-Christians around them as kind of an enemy, and that having relationships of trust with non-Christians is not seen as faithful, but seen as dangerous, right? So that's one example of, in some types of huddled churches, how, you know, they view people not as lost souls who need to be befriended on their journey. And so that is a big difference. In a witnessing church, the non-Christians around you are seen as people that God is moving in their life, and that it's actually faithful to have relationships of trust. I mean, real friendships with the non-Christians around you. And so that, yes, that's definitely one difference between a huddled, you know, being in a huddled church or a community that really doesn't celebrate evangelistic relationships, versus being in a culture that does celebrate that and actually holds it up as a Christian virtue, you know, that we would have friends that aren't believers, and that's actually a purposeful, dignified, beautiful thing to be about. So that would be it, and that was one of the differences that we saw, yeah, is how you view the world around you goes a long way in whether or not you're actually going to be engaged in sharing the faith.
Got a break coming up in just a minute or so. But I was thinking as I was looking over the book again how, you know, that first threshold of trust, that's a lot of kind of pre-evangelism, isn't it? I mean, it's not about just, well, yeah, we'll get the church to do a program or an event or something, but this is about long-term relationships.
That's right. And I mean, in our research and in our experience, that is totally key. And that's why in our book, there are some churches who hold evangelistic events, but that we don't really see, and maybe even people come to faith, but that's not necessarily a witnessing community. Does that make sense? So just because a church holds an event, it doesn't mean that there's a culture in the church and in the congregation of people relating with non-Christians and helping lead them to faith. Nothing wrong with events, and we talk a lot about events in the book, but evangelistic events alone does not necessarily guarantee that you are an evangelistic community that really highly values building trust with non-Christians.
Love to be a part of a fellowship that is breaking the huddle and moving from being a witnessing community to a conversion in community. And we'll talk about what that looks like in the moments ahead with Don Everts, the minister of outreach at Bonham Presbyterian Church in Chesterfield, Missouri, author of several books, including I Once Was Lost, and the new book he's co-authored, Breaking the Huddle. We've got some copies to give away. You can sign up for a free copy. Great resource. It's 877-93-FAITH. That's our phone number, 877-93-FAITH. More with Don Everts just ahead. Now, most Christians are stuck in the huddle, right? I mean, I certainly admit that. We believe in outreach, but our communities often tend to focus on our own needs. And that turns us into insular groups without many relationships with outsiders. So evangelism is occasional and conversations are rare. We want to change that. Maybe that's one of your resolutions, one of your goals for the new year. I hope so. How do we effectively, winsomely share our faith? We're talking Breaking the Huddle today with Don Everts. Don's co-author of a new book, with Val Gordon, Doug Schaap, that has focused on one of his previous works called I Once Was Lost, where they lay out five important stages or thresholds of how to share faith in a postmodern culture. Breaking the Huddle, by the way, from University Press, and there's some additional resources online at ivpress.com. You want to look for that, Breaking the Huddle. Don is a minister of outreach at Bonhomme Presbyterian Church in suburban St. Louis, Missouri, and has written several books. Don, I know you focus on John chapter 4 kind of throughout the book, and maybe just talk about some of the lessons principles we can pull out of that as we talk about moving to become not just a witnessing community, but a conversion community, and we should explain what that means as well.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, in John 4, you have the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman who interacts with Jesus, and it's so fascinating to watch Jesus befriend her and build trust and pique her curiosity. I mean, Jesus is great at evangelism, right? That should not surprise us.
Yeah.
but one interesting feature is when she leaves, when his disciples come back, and she leads her whole village out to Jesus. And so her one God moment, like her interaction with Jesus at the well, actually turns into this big thing. I mean, it's a huge movement. Her whole village comes to check Jesus out. And that's one of the things that we noticed, and there are a number of places that that we've interacted with, that we visited, that we call conversion communities, and they're just red hot for evangelism, right? These are places where evangelism is kind of the center of everything a church does, and there are lots of non-Christians involved in the fellowship. It's not uncommon to see 10 to 20% of the total number of people who are there coming to faith every year. So it's a regular ongoing thing. But one of the features is we kind of interviewed leaders there and folks in those communities that really stood out to us was that they are trained and convinced in those contexts that every God moment may become a God movement. In other words, I'm not just thinking about sharing my faith with this friend of mine, and when I see him come to faith, there are some of us, and I count myself among them, my tendency when I see someone come to faith is to celebrate and then take a vacation. Like, man, that was hard work walking with them to the faith. But in these conversion communities, they are saying, okay, there's a God moment. Someone came to faith. Is God maybe doing a God movement here? Who are the people in that person's life? Who are their friends? What's their work environment like? And might God be using this moment in their life to draw other people to faith? It's kind of a, if you will, like a tribal kind of evangelism. And we were amazed and just humbled by stories in communities where one person comes to faith. And, the story of this gal who came to faith on this campus in San Diego. And then someone said to her early on, because she struggled with different eating disorders and all that, and they just said, I wonder if God is maybe healing you so that you would be a blessing to other people. And then this non-Christian who just came to faith, right, so they're a brand new Christian, immediately was thinking about maybe God wants to affect other women on this campus through me. And then they saw all these other people come to faith through her. So that's an example of, you know, following Jesus' example. The woman at the well is this beautiful God moment, but then rather than, you know, take a nap after he interacted with her, he kept his eyes up. And, you know, what did he say to the disciples when they came back? He said that the fields are ripe for harvest right now. And that's one of these habits we noticed in conversion communities is that their eyes are always up on the harvest. And anytime there's a God moment, they're asking God, are you doing something more here? If there's something more you're doing that we could be faithful in kind of partnering with you. Beautiful stories of whole families, whole segments of a community or a campus that are touched through one person's conversion.
Even as I was reading through that again, I thought, you know, what I hadn't really considered it before. Jesus said, you know, look up, the fields are white, the harvest. I mean, it's possible that those disciples, actually, as they did look up, they see this woman coming with her whole village. I mean, literally, the harvest was coming to them. What a picture of what God's heart is all about if we simply are in tune with where he wants to lead us.
And the disciples, ironically, are preoccupied with food. If you read John 4, they're saying, well, we went and got food. Jesus, aren't you going to eat? And he's, well, I've got, you know, I'm doing my father's work right here. So ironically, they're acting in a huddled way, right? They're attending to their own needs. They're preoccupied with their own needs. And Jesus is saying, look, just look up. Look, they're coming from this village right here. And so that's one of the features of a conversion community is they're always lifting their eyes up. And they're curious. God, what are you doing around me right now? I'm not going to just be preoccupied with my needs and my hungers. I'm going to look up and see what you're doing.
It seemed like in that there's a willingness to wait and not to sort of just rush to the next step, right? Or to give opportunity to say, is there anyone else? I mean, it's almost like the Billy Graham line, what, the buses will wait. I mean, it's not quite like that, but
yeah,
there's an aspect to that, isn't it?
There is. And in fact, when we were interviewing leaders at conversion communities, and this is everything from an Anglican church in London to a campus fellowship and everything in between, the leaders build space into their programs. They build waiting into their programs. And so if you're leading from up front, you know, you're trained not just to do an altar call, for example, but then to linger in the moment and to ask God, what are you doing? And this is one of the distinct advantages, one of many, of relational evangelism, because it's extraordinary if one person on their own going to an event becomes a Christian. And God can really use that. He can do whatever he wants with that, right? But what we have found is that if someone has a Christian walking with them, who maybe goes to the event with them or leads them to faith, then you have someone with relationship who is being patient, asking God, okay, you came to faith. I wonder what else God may be up to right now. Hey, you know, I met your family last weekend, or, you know, whatever it is, right? It's where relationship and trust exists, there it increases the odds of us being attentive and noticing these little hints, these little nudges from God that maybe he's actually up to more. And in conversion communities, that's normal. I've never had a conversion community be my church home. It sounds wonderful and kind of scary, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, I think that maybe that's true. I mean, that's one of our concerns is that we somehow feel like, well, we're not adequate for this task, and indeed we're not, which is why God's Spirit, does the work through
that's right.
us, right? Yeah. Don, say a bit about how maybe your prayer life has changed, and just say a bit about those who want to be sensitive to, you know, not just only the God moments, but maybe, you know, God movement. What do you pray for? How is it different from when you were back on campus in Boulder?
Yeah, that's a good question. My prayer life was really formed on campus in a lot of ways, but I will say this. When you're dealing with college students, you know, kind of at a residential school where they've left their life and they're there for a short period of time, you know, 4 or 5 years. There's a real appropriateness to urgency, right? College age people, they're asking questions about what kind of adult they want to be. They're asking deep questions. Their life is a laboratory during those years. And so there's a right kind of urgency about sharing the faith. What I find now is I minister in a larger suburban church in a context where, you know, I'm sharing the faith with people who have mortgages and minivans, you know, and who maybe have a lifetime behind them of living a certain way, who are connected in with a rich network of people. It has changed how I've prayed in terms of walking with someone, building trust with them, and not having, still being urgent, but then just also having a patience. You know, this is someone's story, and they're living their life. So it's changed. So I find myself praying for patience more, praying for God, who do you want me to walk with for an extended period of time? And then the other piece is this piece of, you know, the harvest, you know, the fields are ripe for the harvest. You know, I have a friend here at Bonham who came to faith, and I walked with him through his journey. And he's connected into, you know, his extended family. He works where he works. He has a lot of relationships. And just naturally have found myself trying to help coach him and encourage him as his instinct, he's a new believer, right? So his instinct is to share with others and helping coach him through that. And I never would have thought in those categories before, right? On campus, students are plucked out of their normal tribal context, if you will, and they're put in this kind of, you know, social experiment of all these young adults living together. But where I minister now, people have roots and relationships, and I have seen more of that kind of tribal evangelism at work. So it's changing how I think about people's stories, how long it takes someone sometimes to become curious about Jesus and to be open to change. It's one thing to be open to change when you're 18. It's another, you know, I've seen 60-year-olds, 70-year-olds experience life change in Jesus. That's a different story, you know? To have 60 years of living for yourself or of living, you know, isolated from God mostly, and then to come alive. And my prayer life has grown more curious, more patient, and bigger in some ways.
Now, we only have a minute or so left. Just what's your prayer, your hope as, you know, this book circulates and people, you know, look at, I want to be more passionate about sharing my faith. What one thing could you leave us with?
You know, the big one would be the reality is God is the one who is calling people to him. You know, Jesus said, no one can come to me unless the Father draws them. And I actually find great comfort from that fact and evangelistic zeal coming from that. God is doing something. He is the one calling people to him. And my hope and why we write these books and all is that it makes it, I think sometimes we overcomplicate or we try partnering with God in ways that aren't necessarily wise or fitted to the people around us. And so my hope is that people more naturally, in a way fitted for the village we live in and the people who are around us, that God can actually use us in what he's already doing in calling people to him. That's a wonderful, mysterious, beautiful, organic thing, and it's a little bit addicting. So don't see evangelism as a duty or a thing you have to grunt and try to make happen. It's a beautiful, mysterious, spiritual thing that God allows us to partner with him in.
Encouragement from Don Everts today, minister of outreach at Bonham Presbyterian Church, Missouri, and author of several books, including I Once Was Lost and the new one he's co-authored, Breaking the Huddle. You can find out more about this book and other resources at ivpress.com. Don, blessings to you. Thanks so much for connecting with us today.
Thank you, Neil, for having me. God bless you and your listeners.
Coming up in a moment, Kim Cattola joins us. Stay tuned for that. Hey, you're listening to Connecting Faith, and want to connect with Kim Cattola right now, who's heard each weekend, Sunday night, here on Faith Radio, Cradle My Heart Radio, and we want to talk with Kim about this past Sunday was Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, and get some perspective. How valuable and important is this?
Well, a lot of people still aren't familiar with it because a lot of churches really haven't jumped on board with it, Neil, but this is something that I recently learned that President Reagan initiated back, I think, in 1984, and he declared January 22nd, Sanctity of Human Life Day, with a presidential proclamation. And so generally churches will observe the Sunday closest to that day as Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, but because it moves around, some churches actually will celebrate any time in the month of January. And the reason for this was to commemorate the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton decisions making abortion legal. So Sanctity of Human Life has been around now since the early 80s, and churches can participate in a number of ways. I know Focus on the Family has some great resources where you can download bulletin inserts, for example, or they have videos that you could use in a worship service. there are places, I think American Pastors Network may have some sermon notes. There are lots and lots of ways that churches can get involved if you're wanting to do that, or if you're wanting to make a suggestion to your pastor. There are lots of resources that are out there.
You know, it does recall that significant Supreme Court decision back in 1973. It's pretty staggering when we think of the real numbers, what, the 58 million or so babies lost to abortion since 1973. We can't even fathom that kind of impact on a culture, on a nation.
The silence around abortion, Neil, is so strong. And I know when I was called to begin speaking out about it following the Lord's healing of an abortion in my heart and in my past, I was so isolated and so ignorant that I thought I really was one of the only very few people that had an abortion. I didn't know anybody else who had. And many people remain unaware of the fact that a million children die every year in legal abortions. And so, yeah, I mean, it's been 44 years, and it's actually over a million. So that is the best number that we have, that right now, 44 years on, it stands at about 59 million babies that have been aborted since legalization.
There was, I think, a recent Pew Research study about, you know, how people view Roe v. Wade and what they'd like to see changed. Where's the... maybe the political will or climate today, would you say?
Well, President-elect Trump is appearing to be following through on his campaign promises for a pro-life administration, particularly when it comes to his Supreme Court nominee. And Kellyanne Conway, scheduled to speak at the March for Life. These are really... No sitting president has ever spoken, by the way. Some have sent video messages. There have been hints that maybe Trump or Mike Pence, vice president-elect, would be at the march this year. But I think that, you know, when it comes to our opinions, Neil, I don't know. I mean, I've often said, and maybe you and I have talked about this, I think abortion remains legal because the middle class wants it as an economic future insurance policy for their daughters. I don't think it's primarily women who are poor who are driving the abortion business in the United States. I think it's people who have values that really stand against it, but who see it as some sort of a necessary evil. And so, you know, as we think about how people feel about Roe v. Wade, our job is to help people understand, you know, that life begins at conception, life begins to have value then, and that, you know, it's wrong, therefore, to take the life of an innocent human being through abortion, and to raise up a generation that knows that, that believes it, and that can stand on it to apply our faith and our ingenuity to come up with better answers. Hopefully to, you know, get people to not have sex outside of marriage, but there are many people who are married who are having abortions as well. And it comes down to, you know, a choice that women feel they need in different circumstances, but one that really is detrimental, of course, to the children involved, but also to the men and women who choose it. And so it's a matter of winning hearts and minds, I think.
You know, I was just thinking the other day, Bill Meyer had a guest on talking about having gone through the abortion experience and talking about the value of ultrasounds. You know, that everybody, it's clear to see now that this is a baby in the womb. But it made me wonder, are those that are wrestling with wondering if they should choose abortion, do they actually have ultrasounds? Or is that something that you only get if you are looking forward to actually delivering a child?
Some states mandate that a woman must be shown an ultrasound image before she can have an abortion. Some states have it optional. So it's a state-by-state policy, if you will. But what's interesting to me, Neil, is that women will say, I heard a woman recently say that, you know, I was shown a picture of a fetal development, and that began to educate me. I didn't know that babies have a face and fingers and toes, you know, so early in their development, very, very early on. Now, the new research out of Oxford says the heartbeat can be detected at 16 days past conception. And so, but what they will come back and say is that it didn't become my baby until I saw the ultrasound. And there's a real difference between an abstraction of, oh, that's what a baby looks like, versus, oh, my goodness, there's an image of my baby. And so ultrasound, I think, is a real game changer. And there are some studies that bear that out, that as high as 95% of women who see an ultrasound will not abort.
Coming up in a few days, March for Life and activities around the nation on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Say a word, Kim, about those that maybe haven't been really engaged. Is there one step we could take to say, I want to affirm this more and live out a value of life in my Christian faith?
Well, Neil, as my mentor John Ensor has said, the pro-life cause is really saving innocent lives one woman at a time. And so whether you're supporting or volunteering or working at a pregnancy health center to directly give aid and support to a pregnant woman, or whether you're doing something like activism by attending the March for Life, it's all good and it all counts. And there are lots of other ways to uphold the sanctity of human life. But I think the March for Life is really unique in that it's been it started right after the Roe v. Wade decision. A small group of people said, we want to protest this on behalf of the children. So the March for Life really is an effort to defend the human rights and the civil rights of the unborn, and it is political activism. There are women every year and men who give their testimony of how abortion harmed them, because the march takes you from the one end of the from the Washington Monument to the Supreme Court. So it's that mall in Washington, D.C. And I went for the 40th anniversary, and it was 500,000 people that year. And, it's quite something to realize how many, when you talk about Pew Research, right, to be among people who see the truth and are willing to stand for the truth is very, very energizing and motivating, because I think if we just look at the news or if even just have conversations, and sometimes even with other Christians, it can be very easy to feel as though our opinions aren't mattering or though we're in such a minority that we're not having any impact. I think March for Life is a great way to encourage ourselves, and as well as making a statement to the culture around us.
Kim Cotola, sought-after writer and speaker, host of Cradle My Heart Radio, heard each Sunday evening here on the Faith Radio Network at 8 o'clock Central Time. I encourage you to listen in for it and to find ways that you can be more engaged in supporting life.
Do you have neighbors? Can you bake cookies? Do either of those things have anything to do with evangelism? Well, Jay Dennis and his wife Angie think that it does.
My wife is such a relationship builder, and now for over 8 years, she has been sharing the gospel with our next door neighbor, and now she's to the point where she will listen to my wife because she has gained credibility through lots of cookies and cakes and reaching out to her children.
Jay and Angie love that God has surrounded them with neighbors who do not yet know Christ.
We love that God has put us in that position. We share our faith because Jesus Christ changed our lives.
Taking some cookies next door could be the starting point of an eternal friendship. For more ideas, go to makingyourlifecount.com. I'm Steve Douglas.
I'm in favor of cookie evangelism.
Amen.
That sounds good. We've talked about Breaking the Huddle today with Don Everts. Again, you can find out more about the resources on that book and other resources they've got for churches at ivpress.com. Don Everts from Bonham Presbyterian Church, author of a wonderful book called I Once Was Lost as well. Check that out. Tomorrow, we're talking education. Education, one of the big agenda items in the new administration, but political changes alone aren't going to be enough to help the 16 million American children in poverty, dramatically underserved by the public school system. And Cole Baker Fulgham believes that the church holds the key. We're going to talk about educating all God's children tomorrow on Connecting Faith.
Neil, we're circling some dates on the calendar, getting ready for the spring and summer. Date that people should circle right now is July 15th. It's going to be our first annual Northwestern Christian Writers Conference. Aspiring writers are encouraged to attend. You can look at NorthwesternChristianWritersConference.com. We won't forget that long title, but it's
no.
There.
Check it out. Be a part of that, and you'll hear more. Susie Larson this afternoon. We'll talk about that as well. Thank you for listening. By the way, if you missed part of today's program, want to hear it again, you can always find the interviews. We post them online on the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.